Peter Wilt from Club 9 Sports is going to be with us here. There he is. Peter Wilt, who's been on the show many times talking about many subjects, and we'll probably cover a lot of them today. Peter, how are you, sir?
Really good. You know, my throat, I may not sound like I usually do. I'm getting over a cold, so I've got that sexy soccer executive voice going, Jason.
So hopefully that'll work as you go about the business of making deals and getting soccer clubs started. Peter, we obviously are here sort of in the shadow of what U.S. Soccer decided to do with the second division sanctioning. This is directly related to your work at the moment. I think a lot of people have kind of come to the conclusion that this was the right choice for the moment. Clearly, you're going to have a bias here, but is that your take?
Oh, absolutely. In some ways, it was splitting the baby in half. But importantly, what it did, it created incentives for both leagues to work harder, work smarter, to grow their leagues. This provisional status, and separate from calling it the waivers, but the provisional status really tells each league, get your act together, meet the standards, or you're not going to keep your sanctioning. So it forces each league to examine themselves, be honest about it, and work for the next 12 months to get things together. And that's a good thing for the sport.
Well, the standards themselves came out of the last time we had a kind of a kerfuffle in the second and third division, the NASL splitting from the USL back in, was 2009, 2010. And I guess maybe some people would wonder, and I'll get your take here, why have requirements, why have standards if there are going to be waivers?
Well, that's a... I thought the question was going to be, why have it if you don't have promotion relegation?
Well, that too. We're going to come to that.
Yeah, and certainly it sets a bar. At some point, you need to set those parameters so people know what the divisions are supposed to look like. And waivers, I think, should be granted call it exceptional circumstances, and with the idea that eventually they get resolved. And by doing this in a provisional way, I think it achieves that. Certainly you don't want to be giving waivers for the same thing for unlimited number of times.
Right, as you said, provisional, get your house in order. This does mean that it has to be revisited. What does it mean? I guess we'll come to the specifics for your efforts here. What does the second division provisional sanctioning for the NASL do for you as you go about the business of trying to help grow that league?
Well, importantly, it keeps the New York Cosmos in. I think, you know, their participation was contingent upon that. So it keeps the league existing. It also creates an image. It's optics in a lot of ways because it doesn't have a practical purpose in terms of promotion and relegation. But the optics are important for players, for broadcasters, I suppose, for sponsors to a certain extent. So there is a value to it. For the fans, you know, I don't think there's as much of an issue for the fans between Division 2 and Division 3, let's say, as opposed to Division 1 and Division 2. That makes a huge difference for fans.
So, again, we're talking about your efforts to help the NASL grow. And here in Los Angeles, there's been a lot of talk about this particular area and the market. Obviously, Los Angeles is a very broad, big kind of market. There's different specific areas. You have you mentioned Orange County to me before we came on the air, and that is something that we've heard. What is the process as you go through this here, and you know, how careful do you have to be about getting the right people involved, and then, you know, making sure that, you know, stability is part of this?
I think that's a great example of, I'll call it, the old NASL and hopefully the new NASL, because I think one of the big issues that a lot of people, including myself, had concerns with, the call it the old NASL, meaning version 2, is that the vetting process wasn't proper. And we as a league were letting in ownership groups and teams that were not properly prepared. And the Orange County group, there was a push to get them in for the fall of 2017 in order to make sure those U.S. soccer standards were met. And that's the wrong reason to accept a team. The team should be brought in when they're ready. So now I think you're going to look and see that the NASL is vetting the teams more carefully. They're giving them more time, giving them hopefully more resources. Be a centralized league to the extent that you're providing advisory services, human resources, information, best practice sharing, so that these teams and also new ownership groups. I mean, Fort Lauderdale Strikers have been around a long time, but they had the same issue that, let's say, Rio had, in that they were not prepared from a business standpoint.
It's I talked a little bit on this show about the structure of American sports being very league focused as opposed to club focused, and I think that's it's kind of a simplistic way of looking at it, but you could say that in England or certain traditional soccer countries, the club comes first, and it kind of doesn't. It matters where you play, but the existence of the club is not necessarily dependent on the existence of the league. If you know what I'm saying, there's going to be some sort of structure. We're going to schedule some games, and everybody's going to play each other. It happened 150 years ago, and now it is in the form it is. In America, I mean, this is why it was important for the NASL to get that second division sanctioning, so that the league could continue, so that the teams that want to be in the NASL have a place to play. And I'm coming to this because obviously you started Indy 11, a club that, by most of what I've heard, is fairly comfortable and happy in NASL, doesn't necessarily have those big MLS aspirations right now, and certainly doesn't seem like a good fit for USL. What would have happened if NASL had collapsed to a club like Indy 11?
And every market in the NASL had its own set of parameters and issues and circumstances. I believe in Indianapolis's case, ownership would have continued the team, and likely in USL, there's a chance a new league could have been formed in the void. It probably would have taken a year to get off the ground, which would have meant Indy 11 would have had to decide, do they take a year off and wait for the new league,
right,
or do they go right away into USL? And, the reason that each team has to ask their questions of what they want to do, a lot of it has to do with the ownership structure of the leagues.
Mm. Peter, you have talked pretty consistently about your desire to see promotion and relegation come to the United States, but you've been very pragmatic about the approach to trying to figure out how to do it. It can't just be one day we have it. It's not going to work that way. You came on our show months ago, and we talked about your criteria for starting soccer clubs in various cities. That's out there for people to read. You teased a promotion and relegation plan. I know you've had some back and forth with people on Twitter. You mentioned it's going to be coming out hopefully this month through Howler Magazine. What's going to be included in there? How do we get to promotion and relegation?
It is more of a manifesto, so I won't be able to go into all the details on this. I think it's over 8,000 words. Half of it is the arguments for pro rel and the arguments against it. And a lot of that is going to be old information for a lot of people. But the interesting part for me is thinking and talking and discussing how it could be implemented in the United States in various forms, including in ways that it would make sense for the couple dozen investors in Major League Soccer. Because, frankly, those are the people that Right. have the most to lose. And they're the ones that have invested the most in the sport. And frankly, I believe their concerns should be discussed in all this. And they obviously need to buy into it if they're going to be involved. Now, you don't have to involve MLS to do pro rel. A couple of the samples I put out in the article will talk about doing it without Major League Soccer's participation. But some of them talk about how it could be implemented with safeguards and incentives that would protect, not only protect MLS owners, but also in a way that it would benefit them so that the upside is strong enough mm-hmm. to offset any risk.
Clearly, the biggest hurdle is MLS and the participation of a league that has first division status already and the clubs who might not be amenable to going down. But what about the other side of things and the question of there being clubs in this country in certain towns where, okay, maybe they win a championship, but their owners aren't going to be ready to drop a couple million dollars to move up a level.
That's a great point. And what needs, to me, that's an opportunity. I think if a team is being promoted, but they don't have the resources to do so, I suppose you give them the option to be promoted, but you give them the incentive to find the investors to make it work for them. And that will grow that club, it will grow the league, and it will grow the sport if more investment money comes into the sport. And it's probably to the tune of certainly hundreds of millions of dollars cumulatively, if not billions of dollars. So the opportunity to grow the sport through pro rel is real, and through the teams being promoted, it means that they're going to have the opportunity to raise more money.
Do you think that the balance is right? I mean, whether it's now or 10 years from now, I guess that's the question. The balance is right between the simple growth of professional soccer in this country to the point that it's a relevant sport that really doesn't have to worry about stability going forward, and that may never be the case at some of the smaller clubs and smaller towns, versus what could come through investment in a promotion and relegation system.
Yeah, I think the time is right. You know, I've worked in the sport on the business side for more than 30 years, and in the last 5 years, I've never seen anything like it in terms of the interest in investment and the growth of it from a business standpoint. I'm now working with Club 9 Sports, and you know, our mission is to find resources for new markets, raise capital for these new teams, and provide the advisory services so they can be successful. And now I'm finding that these investors are out there. I think it's part of the age wave of soccer passionate people. Well, we think of it in terms of fans. Maybe we think of it in terms of sports editors and sponsor decision makers, season ticket holder decision makers. But it's also for investors. And now you're having these 30 and 40-year-old people that are high net worth individuals. They have a passion for soccer, and they want to see the sport the way it's played in the rest of the world. So I think if ProRel is offered to them, there's going to be a market for it, both with domestic investors and international investors.
Is that and you mentioned a model that maybe doesn't include Major League Soccer, if that becomes too much of a sell to that league. Is that, does that meet the standard of, you know, what is appropriate? I mean, is that really a promotion and relegation system, or is that a half-baked thing? Yeah,
right. Yeah, I think it's a process. You know, whether it includes MLS or not, I think there's a transition, right? You don't just leap into it one day. So that transition is not going to be exactly like it is in the rest of the world. But I think you have to start somewhere. And if you put it in the model in place, over time, it will get there.